West Virginia. To whom we are deeply grateful not only for their financial support of the Augusta program, but for forcing us to delve into this whole area of folk life, study, and celebration that so often gets left out. You can go a lot of places and learn fiddle tunes. Here you can come and learn about the fiddler, and learn about the society that fiddler comes from, and what, besides fiddling, he thinks is important, and how fiddling has set him apart in a society that dearly loves old-time music. You can learn all that firsthand from discussions like these, and from mingling with, dining with, visiting with people who are here. So this is an ideal setting in which humanity's issues about the folk arts can be raised. And, I don't think it needs to be an alienating idea, thinking about the who and the why after we thought about the what and the how. Of folk art and folk life, folk living, folk experience. It doesn't have to be an alienating and totally academic exercise. I think that there are all kinds of learning here in West Virginia which have reached a very, very high plane, a very lofty plane, a very civilized plane. And that a lot of these ideas are not written down in books, but they're in people's heads and in people's daily lives. And that's interest in that sort of thing raises, I think, kind of easily a lot of this area of the humanities, and it doesn't have to be something that scares us away necessarily. So we've got a remarkable group of people assembled here. Maybe we could just go around, starting with you, Pemberton.
What do you want from me? I think I know somewhat maybe what you want. I can identify with the lady here that don't know me at all. But talking about her weaving,
Her name is Dorothy Thompson.
Dorothy Thompson. Yeah. I know you now. You don't know me. You haven't heard me talk yet, but I know you. I was interested in what you said about selling enough to buy some material. That started back when you was a little girl. Mommy didn't let you waste your time, didn't it?
Right.
And the pride is still there.
Right.
Every bit. With me, I don't really have much, so far as I'm concerned. The tree is where it's at, and the woods is where it's at, where I was born and raised. I wondered this morning when I went to breakfast, how many people heard a cardinal outside the dining room door?
What was he saying? What?
I can't whistle because I'm nervous. But anyhow, I didn't see him, but he was a cardinal all right. And many other birds I observed on the way to walk. But not to embarrass you, but how many people heard a bird on the way to breakfast this morning? They was all there, but I wonder how many people stopped a while like God did and listened to them. I mean, I grew up 9 in the family. I was born during the Depression. We wasn't lucky enough to live somewhere where we'd get on that farm you're talking about. So, in the communities, she wasn't too interested in making baskets then. There's probably somebody else not too far away. And you didn't need 2 basket makers. You didn't need 2 butchers. My daddy could do any of them to keep us all alive. You talked about not having money. I'm not interviewing you, am I?
No.
Anyhow, you didn't need it. You took
it back. We didn't know we were poor.
We didn't.
We wasn't.
Right. We didn't.
You're one of the richest women in the room.
Right.
I don't care if you don't have a dollar in your pocket. We took a basket of eggs on each arm, and if you're lucky enough coming down the side of the mountains, you didn't fall on an elbow in each basket. You got to the store, you got what was needed.
Right.
You learned to eat your cornbread with salt on it instead of sugar. I couldn't stomach a bowl of cornbread. with sugar on it yet. I put a little salt on mine. But anyway, you bought what you had to have, and you got a little due bill. Did you ever see one?
Yeah.
The storekeeper gave you no money. He gave you a due bill. That was keeping him going over the other hill, which would have been Silver Hill, my place, and buying something off of that storekeeper, because you got to come back where the due bill comes from. And my uncle, great-uncle, owned the 173 acres we lived on. He charged us 50% for living there. So if you had to raise enough to feed 11, you had to raise enough to feed 22. And when you butchered in the fall, you had a pole between two forked sticks with maybe two dozen holes coming right out that pole. And why, I'll never know. I'm supposed to talk about toys, aren't I? Why, I'll never know. My daddy and mommy always ate the hams first. I don't know why.
Before, what did they save for last? The necks and the backbone?
The fat back.
Fat back, yeah.
It was salted down. He'd keep all summer anyway.
Yeah.
So you live high on the hog. That's the meaning of the expression. Butcher and time, you live high on the hog. But I'm telling you about butcher and time again. Maybe the fat back even run out. But we're talking about toys. And I'm sorry I got off on something else. And I don't want to take up too much of your time. But you wanted to know whatever interested me in it in the first place and why I'm trying to keep it alive. When I was a little boy, it amazed me that my daddy was sold on a sled. Now, he had to knock teeth out with that thing, because he took the hickory and bent it down over the shoe on the sled, and you pinned it down a wooden peg. But the odd thing to me was, he bored a round hole and hewed him out a square peg. And I was just little, and I said, how come you're driving a square peg in a round hole? And he said, you make it a little bigger than the hole, and you drive it, that sole will never come off till it wears out. You put the round peg in the round hole, and when it dries out, it'll slip off, and your soul will fall asleep. So that's where I just landed last night. I couldn't sleep for some reason. Maybe it's because I was going to be here. And I was thinking back, and I was trying to think back how far I became interested in wood. And that's as far back as I can remember my age. I do not know what I was at that time. But back to the wood, and then I'll shut up. You can take a limb off a black walnut. You want a set of candlesticks to look alike. It's an absolute impossibility.
Right.
You turn this one on the lathe, you don't know what he's going to look like. He's like that rag rug that I can hook to if I want to. I have. But anyway, you don't know what the color's going to look like until you get in there. Well, when your lathe is running, you see no grain. You learn to turn that thing as slick as possible, because sandpaper in a lathe runs crossways and wood don't like sandpaper. So you learn to turn that slick, an old file. Best thing in the world to make a knife out of. But you turn that thing and you get it where it's just right. It feels so soft, smooth, and nice to you. You set it down and you set it over here. Now, you may have skill enough to make one exactly the same size. But while it's running in the lathe, it looks exact mate. You take it out of there, it's as different as your fingerprints is in mine. And you will never find a handcrafted item exactly the same. If you do, somebody made it somewhere on manufacturer and they're cheating somebody.
It's the same thing.
Cheating somebody out
of
it. Now, I'm going to shut up.
All of you were saying?
Huh?
You were saying?
I said it's the same in weaving. You seldom ever. I mean, I can make something, and five or six other people can make the same thing, and they'll somehow be a little bit different. As he's talking with the wood. Right.
That's why you can't hire, though we wholesale nationwide, you can't hire enough of employees to really make you any great amount of money until you destroy the quality of your product.
Mm-hmm.
Because the craft has the craftsman in it.
Mm-hmm.
And if he bought it and sold it, I can spot him a mile away when I go to a festival.
Yes, that's one problem, I think. I think with your crafts, that's one problem we have in West Virginia. It is with weaving, too. And that is that we can't sell it. What we sell it for, really, is just the material price. Your labor is free. You can't get out of it what you're putting in it, in labor and material. So actually, craft is being short-changed. Now, you take it to New York or some of these big places, you know, places that they sell a lot of this sort of thing, and you can put your price on it there, and you can make a living. But we're not in New York. We're here.
Yeah,
that's a problem.
I can put a full day in. In fact, the matter, I put in 4 or 5 days on the first one, because if it don't suit me, it's like misthread. It goes in the fire.
That's
I heat
right.
My shop with wood.
Mm-hmm.
Only the junk wood.
Mm-hmm.
It's small. But anyway, it may have taken me 4 or 5 days to develop this first one, mm-hmm. then a day to make the product, and I put 4 1/4 on it, and somebody insults me. My land.
The planning. The planning, and before you get to the work, it takes the most time. Same way with weaving.
So this is not something you're going to get rich at, I guess.
Tense not going to get rich.
Depends on what you call rich.
Yeah, right.
Successful, yes. Uh-huh. We got enough to eat, don't we? Don't we?
We have what?
We have enough to eat, don't we?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
I tell some of my, some people that I meet that I'm the richest person in the world. And they think I mean money.
Yeah, but it's not.
A lot of them think I mean money.
It's not satisfaction.
Yeah.
Love.
I tell the Texans I own as far as the eye can see when you step out the back door, and I do.
Yes.
There's only 43 acres and it's straight out.
Well, for one thing, this I have to add. For one thing, it's kept me out of, as my sister-in-law says, off of the streets. Because when I retired, I was not ready to retire. I taught school for 30 years. And when I retired, I wasn't ready to retire yet. And weaving has saved my life. And it's been really, I think it's been the best part of my life. It's been far better. From the time I retired until now, I've had more fun.
I just got to say something.
Yeah, and I think you have to.
In 66, the doctor gave me 5 years to live if I take a pace setter.
Yeah.
I refused a pace setter. He said, cigarettes will kill you. I said, you told me you're going to die anyhow. I still got the cigarettes, and I'm going to live 20 years later, and crafts kept me there. Mm-hmm. I'd have been dead a long time ago if I sat down.
Well, look at the example of Woody Simmons in music. I mean, Woody's been... outlived everybody's expectations, and only by determination and music, you know.
Mm-hmm. Sure, it gets the old adrenaline flowing.
You got it.
What about this subject, Ethel?
I feel like a young whippersnapper.
Keeping the old ways alive. What is it important to do that?
It's very important. If my father had lived, he would have been 89 today. 89 years old. So that tells you something about my, I'm 36. So that tells you he was kind of old when I came along. And most of my values are very old fashioned because of the way I was reared. Because of that, I saw as a young person, I worked with older people all most of my life. When I had a choir in the church at 9, my mother was part of the choir. And it's very difficult to tell your mother when she's singing wrong. But that was my way to get around her. And if, you know, if something was wrong, I wanted to perfect it. And during the youngest part of my life, I saw and heard so many things from older people. And then when I would be around, as I began to associate in school and then later on in college, I found that a lot of the values that I had, many others considered old-fashioned, including in music. And that was when I decided I was determined to expose younger people, especially in my culture, to some of the old ways, because I could tell that those old ways were quickly dying in our culture. And it's very, very true. If you would survey people, young people in 20 and 30 or younger, some of the things, some of the styles of music, they will not know anything about. They won't know anything about it. They don't even know the first place to go, where to find it, or even have any reference, any type of reference from their mind to how to keep it. So my determination from, I think about the, right after high school, I decided that I was going to try to learn as much as I could possibly learn before the old ones died, so that I could pass it on. Because I'm so afraid that if I don't, there might be, especially in the area that I live in, there won't be any way to promote it. I was talking to a lady this weekend about coming to do some shake note singing for me, to teach me how to do it. And she had tears in her eyes. She said, I'll be glad to come. And she said, because nobody wants to learn it.
It's amazing.
And it really hurt me. She says, I tried to teach it to the young people in my church, and they laughed at me and told me they didn't want to learn that old stuff. And that's bad when you have kids with that attitude, because somebody better learn it and preserve it in some way, and we're going to really be in a fix. And there are other people who value us more than we do. And I'm certain there are people in your community that think, oh, well, that's whatever his name is, and, you know, he makes toys. So
why don't you get him to a respectable job and earn your money on it?
Right.
Yeah. I've been told that to my face. However, the girl from France, the French-Canadian girl's in my class, the one that found the knot with the eyelashes already on it and laid the pattern out so the eye came out in the right place, she'll be a craftsman. That's what it's all about. So I can take the insult occasionally, can't you?
Oh, yeah. I'm used to it. I'm usually considered a renegade in my group anyway. If there's something different, I will teach gospel singers to sing the Messiah, because they say, well, that's not the kind of music I sing. You should have a good variety. You should be versatile in anything that you do. There are all different facets of music. When you're talking about music, as well as any of the crafts and handiwork that you might do, there are different facets of it, and we need to learn all of the areas so that we can share something with someone else.
Ethel, can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
A while ago, you said that you wanted to learn shape note singing, and that a lot of people didn't, and I understand that. And you said, and what if nobody learned it? Then we'd be in a fix.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of fix would we be in?
We'd lose it. We'd lose our heritage. There's some old ladies that I've met. And I've been delving into trying to figure out how to do oral history and try to do some recording on my own before it's too late. For so many years, Black history itself was not recorded.
Yeah.
And only after the 60s, people started to realize they needed to record the history. And a lot of history right here in West Virginia has been lost forever because no one took the time or even knew that anyone would consider it valuable. I don't consider myself many times much of a musician or a person of any renown. And then I find someone else who finds something in me that they can learn or from me. So I'm learning that as long as I have the energy, I need to do something about preserving what we have so that somebody will want to go back one day and have some type of record and learn something, and they might introduce it as being something new, and you know, there's nothing new in the world.
Yeah.
It's already been here, as the Bible says. And,
well, nobody has gotten further than you have in actually passing what you do on to younger people, and getting all your choirs are filled with young, enthusiastic, very talented people, and so it looks like you're making a lot of progress with getting on with this, but you say other people are having trouble with youngsters.
Many places. I say this not bragging, but I say it as just being on record, that the first Black gospel choir to even be found in a college in West Virginia was in the school that I attended. After that, there started Black gospel choirs throughout. The first community choir that I know anything about as far as a Black gospel emphasizing Black religious music, I started, and afterward I saw others start. And I don't say that braggingly, but I say it, somebody has to be the pace setter. If I don't care if I never get credit. The thing is, the first Black religious gospel, let's put it, the first Black gospel program that had not preaching and praying and teaching, but the first Black program in Charleston, West Virginia that was ever done, that was a continuous thing and still going on, I was the first DJ, Black DJ, to present Black gospel music. Now there are all kinds of them in the city. It doesn't matter to me about my being the first or whatever, but setting that pace to preserve things. And sometimes I'll play some old music on there, maybe maybe just a guy playing a guitar and just singing an old, it sounds like a bluesy song, but it's a gospel song. And somebody will call up and say, what are you playing that junk for? We want to hear Andre Crouch. And I'll say, it's coming. But they need to hear it. Whether they record it or steal it or whatever, they need to hear it. So they'll know the styles of music.
I just want you to know, shape notes is all I know. I know music not at all,
oh.
But I know the eight shape notes, and if I was to make it over, I hope I do, when you're singing,
mm-hmm.
I'll know when you're going to go higher and lower, and with a little bit of ear, I can sing with you.
Oh.
And I don't know nothing about them round things that they got stuck around there. They mean nothing.
Well, our organist, one of the ladies in our church, that's the only book she could play the piano out of is the one with the shaped notes. She couldn't read round note music, which I always thought was wonderful.
Where I go to church, you won't find any round notes. They're all shaped notes. I'm saying that for your benefit so that you'll know that some of us won't let it die,
mm-hmm.
if possible.
Jimmy Costa, what about this question of how does all this apply to fiddle music?
I think the whole crux of the matter, as they'd say, is exactly what everyone's talking about, especially Ethel, is there's something good when there's value and good in something. It doesn't matter whether it's old or new. And the thing that has amazed me through my life is people just shucking something off because, well, people did that in the past, so it's not good anymore. They did that back then. Not weighing and measuring and thinking, there's something good, there's quality about that, there's something, there's value here, let's weigh it and measure. No, just because it happened in if I had that mentality, well, because my dad did that, doesn't interest me, that was in his age and his contemporaries, I want to do what my contemporaries are doing. And I can't understand how people can't see any further than that attitude, that just because it was done 50 years ago, then it's not good now, because we're in 1985 and that was 1935 or 1930, whatever. It seems like that's the attitude I've run into about a lot of things, you know. It has no meaning or quality because it was done back then.
Well, you've added a dimension to this discussion, though, that
quality is quality.
Clearly that if a thing has inherent value, that's just as important as if it's old.
Right.
Or just as much a reason for
it. Yes,
Jim, in case somebody doesn't know, just from hearing you talk this week, I know that you've gone to great pains to surround yourself with a certain type of house and certain types of objects, and you brought some weird instruments of construction. Do you mind telling everybody sort of a little bit about where you live and the place you're going to take your students to tomorrow?
No. Well, the house that I live in now, when I was... I first saw it when I was probably about 10 or 11 years old, and it was on my best friend's grandfather's farm adjoined the land where this old big log house stood. And when I was a kid, I can remember going up there, seeing that old house. We'd go in the upper story of it and shoot groundhogs out of the upper story. It was a big log house, and we'd go up there, and Larry, my best friend, Larry Pennington, and I'd go up there, and we'd plunder around that old house and shoot groundhogs and shoot crows, and everything was abandoned. And that place just always stuck in my mind as something really different and unique from the world and the environment that I grew in, which was a small town. I didn't grow up in the country, but I had the option of going in the country at age 5, and I've been there ever since. When I'll tell you something an old man said to me one time, and I cried when he said it to me. I introduced a friend of mine to this old gentleman who I'm speaking of, my best friend's grandfather. His name was Clarence Cales. He's yet living. He's 94 years old. And I'll never forget as long as I live. His brother Albert was selling his home, and his wife were moving, and I went to the auction because I knew they had a lot of nice old things that had been made in my area, old furniture. There was an old banjo there had been in the family over 90 years. And I went to go to the sale to get these things so I could fix them up and use them, enjoy them, and show them to other people. So I went to the sale, and Albert was on the porch, and the auctioneer was getting things ready, and there was Clarence, and he was on a walker. He'd since had a stroke. And I introduced my friend. I said, this is my friend. I told you about this beautiful farm that he has with the virgin timber and such still on it. And Clarence looked at her and looked at me, and he said, yes. He said, I'm the man that put the country in Jimmy. And I will never forget that as long as I live, because that meant so much to me for that statement that he said, because he and I knew, I think, on the same level what he meant by that statement. Because he had sons that as many people did, left all those ways and were not interested in those ways. They became dentists, they became doctors, they became teachers, and they cared nothing about what the farm life was all about, and the woods and the value of nature and all. And it was just a spiritual thing to me there with what he said to me and what he realized by that statement. There he was, that old and crippled up from a stroke, and that was foremost, and that was foremost with me for what the old man gave me. Yeah.
Man, you're talking about virgin timber. These fellas for a dollar bill will rape a whole hillside.
Yeah, that's right.
And destroy the young as they get it.
And see, he would never allow that. He didn't mind people going in when a tree was mature. He was a timberman all his life for the Meta River Lumber Company. I have the cross-cut saws that he pulled as a young man. That they let him have when he went off the job. And there's timber on his farm standing. I took a forester over there. He said, I've never seen anything like it in my life. There's a stand of nothing but black walnut on his farm that if a man my age would cut, I would never have to work a day in my life from the money that could be procured from that timber. And the old man wouldn't have it, would not have it. He said, now you take one out every now and then. And in fact, he let me have a tree that died, and it was standing, and he said, take that out of there, Jim, make something up out of it if you want it. But it's still intact. Most beautiful thing you ever saw. It's well over 2 acres of nothing but black walnut. Seems like this. It grows on a hillside, and it's straight as an arrow.
More value under the ground than there is above.
Yeah.
Yeah, if you dig the stump.
Dig the stump, yes.
Terry Mills, you live in a out-of-the-way place yourself in a place called Skiles Creek on Birch River in Webster County. And why don't you tell us why you chose to live where you do?
Well, I guess about 12, 13 years ago, I made a conscious decision to move out to a place like the place Mike described on Skiles Creek. And I was living in Pennsylvania at the time, and up there it's quite a bit different than West Virginia in that there's a lot of fine land in Pennsylvania. It's rich farmland, and if you're a young person starting out and you want to get back to a farming lifestyle, it's pretty hard to do unless you inherit it, because the land up there is so expensive that you'd spend your whole life to pay off part of the farm. It's rich farmland, and it's not going to be available to very many young people. So because of music and the prospect of being able to own a piece of land of our own, we came down to West Virginia, and we first lived near here, down in Huttonsville, up the valley here in Huttonsville, for about a year, and we took a farm there for a while, and then found out about this piece of land over on Skiles Creek in Webster County, which is pretty remote, pretty isolated, had no power to the farm, and we moved there with knowing that we'd be living without electricity and doing things pretty much the old ways, because there was no choice. Once you were there, and modern conveniences were going to be out of the question. So we built a house. There was no house left on the old place. It was an old farm. It had a good cellar, a good stone cellar, and that was pretty important, and a good garden spot, and some nice meadows and pastures, and good water. It just seemed ideal for everything we wanted. And getting there, and you start to realize that there's a whole lot you don't know about living. I knew how to garden, and I knew how to do a lot of rural things. I had some skills in that area, but when you start doing things, everything by hand, from carrying your water to you name it, we did it by hand. Built the house by hand with hand saws, hand drills, everything by hand. You have to learn an awful lot, and we had to learn an awful lot real quick. And the best place we found to learn an awful lot real quick was to get to know people like Fermer, Olive, Ethel, Dorothy, people like this. They had the answers. They're the ones that had the answers. They're the ones that had, they grew up that way. So that's where we got a lot of answers real quick for what we needed. We still, it's not something that you just learn like that. So we started out, got the little homestead started there, and have been building. First we got the house built, we got a barn built, we got the chicken house built, and we just slowly made the place. It was a real wild, grown up place, hadn't been lived in for several years, and it finally, and after a period of 10 years now, it's really become home. The old ways of doing things are there were carrying water from a spring, and we had a little joke when we finally got a hand pump mounted in the kitchen. We said it catapulted us right into the 19th century. things went along like that until now. I'm not afraid to utilize whatever technology is available. Until now, we have electricity that I manufacture myself from the creek, but there's still no commercial power lines come near the place. So now we have some things, and are doing some things differently, but basically the pace of life on the place is still the old time way. We still do most things by hand, still do a lot of farming and gardening and whatnot by hand. I hate to admit it in front of all these weavers, but one of the real goals of my life is to do something like saying right over there. My dad is a weaver, and my mother was a weaver. My grandfather was a weaver, my great-grandfather, and we have coverlets that they brought from Yorkshire, England, in the family. So that's always been the family trade, and someday I want to do that.
Speaking about the pace of things, I think you could sit here a long time and try to explain to people what Webster County means to you, and what living on that creek means to you. But I think it maybe if we could ask you to play a fiddle tune. I'd like to hear you play the Upine Mountain, because I think in that one tune you can get many hours of discussion communicated, maybe.
When that thing starts, I wonder if anybody feels like I do. I get the same feeling exactly as I do when the tune out here flag go by.
When did you get interested in music? I wonder. When did you get interested in music?
There's always music in my family. My older brother, who was quite a bit older than me, there's seven kids in my family, and he played the fiddle, and I had a cousin who played the fiddle.
Okay, then it's been your family for a long time. Okay.
And there's always
I just wondered if this came with Webster Springs, too.
Well, it was a real important reason for me settling around here. I really love the music, and especially love the people who make the music. And Mike asked me to play Upine Mountain. I guess one of my best friends these days is Mr. Ernie Carpenter, who lives near me, who grew up on the Elk River and plays some of the oldest style of fiddle music that I've run across. And he's a wonderful person. He's been real good to me. He's taught me anything that I've wanted to learn.
I just wondered if it were new or if it had been. Mm-hmm. That's interesting to know.
So Ernie grew up on the Elk River, and his people were the very first settlers there on the Elk River in 1790. And he plays this fiddle tune about called Upine Mountain, which is where the Elk River starts.
Thank you.
about you and old things?
Well, I grew up in Randolph County here, over in the eastern part of the county near Whitman, and certainly in the country on a farm over there. And I'm a full generation at least behind a lot of you here, but I feel like I probably grew up a lot the same way. It was, certainly wasn't anything like growing up in the Depression, I'm sure of that. But I, you know, I remember farming with horses and that sort of thing. And I guess my own efforts towards preserving old things has been musically. And my mother's family were all musicians. My grandfather was a fiddler. And there were about 11 kids in her family, and all of them played an instrument but one. So there was a lot of music around when I was growing up, and that was the music I started playing as a kid. And there was also, they had square dances and harmony every Saturday night. And they were family type affairs. They weren't just for any particular age group or anything like that. They were family affairs. And when I started playing music, that's really where I first started playing, was at home and at those square dances on Saturday night. And there were a couple fiddlers in the area there that I'd go and see and try to learn, just starting out, just trying to back them up with the guitar, you know. I think I began to realize how important the music was to me. You know, music being an art, it's going to be felt differently by different people, and people interpret it differently. And there's a lot of what is being played today is old-time music that I don't think it is at all, because I think the people haven't come to it with an understanding of what it's all about. They come to it from rock music or from modern country and western music or something.
Recorded.
And recorded, that's right. I mean, when you're playing old-time music and your source is the Highwood String Band, you know, that's and you're considering those your role model, it's a little different thing than taking it from the people who played it as a way of life.
And who were your role models?
Well, certainly over in the Dry Fork area, there were some fiddlers over there and some cousins and uncles to begin with. And since then, I've went away to school in Morgantown and got to meeting other people and doing some traveling around. I've lived in several places in the eastern part of the state between the Pennsylvania and the Virginia border, from Morgantown to Bluefield, which is where I live now. And I guess I've had several different influences. I certainly think that Lee Hammons down in Marlington was probably the biggest influence. He was a pretty incredible person, musically and otherwise.
How'd you meet him?
I met him through Dwight. I met Dwight in Morgantown, Dwight Dillon, and he was from the Marlington area. And he had just gotten interested, I think. He'd been playing the banjo just a couple of years when we met in Morgantown. We found out we were both interested in the old-time music and in finding out more about it and in playing it with an understanding of it, not just to play the notes and have a good time at it necessarily, although you sure do that, but to really try and understand what the music was about. And so he knew that the Hammondses and all of them that were playing music down around Marlington, and that's how I met Lee. And on down in the area where I live now was Oscar Wright, who was another big influence on me. And, I think maybe, I don't know the reason. It's a personal thing, certainly. But when I listen to their music, it's special to me. And it's not just because I knew them, I don't think. But I think it's part of where I grew up. The music reminds me of home. if that makes any sense.
The music has something to do with the place then that it happened?
I think maybe it does for me. It kind of takes me home.
What's so important about home? I mean, a lot of people are trying to get away from where they were raised.
Well, I'm trying to get back. You know, I've spent 10 years trying to get back to where I was raised, and I've made some decisions that at least kept me in the state when I had some pressures to take me out of the state and across the country to Oklahoma or Texas or Oregon. There's no way I would even consider something like that, but...
Does your family still have the same farm? I mean, is the farm that you have?
Yeah.
It's still in
your
family?
Yeah, it's still there.
Mm-hmm.
Father's still there farming.
Harmon?
No, Whitmer, near Whitmer, between Job and Whitmer. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My sister stayed and we just found this out a while ago. My sister taught school in the little one-room school, and she stayed with his father's mother and father. See, he was he probably was about the same age of, no, he'd be younger. He was in her school. Can you imagine that?
Right. Can you give us an example on your banjo of this sense of place and music or something that maybe...
I don't know. Jerry just did,
yeah,
Mike, but I'll try again. Sitting here with my hair on the back of my neck, standing on end while Jerry was playing that ukulele.
You might not be as old as us, but you're older now. You're on the way.
No, I was going to do this in time to get to this special tuning that I want to use here. Give me a minute. I guess the thing that's special about it is the way it sounds, as opposed to
why don't we hear it first and then we can ask him what he's doing.
Well, this is a tune that Lee Hammond's played. It's always one of my favorites. It was called The Dead Man's Piece, and the story is that he said that the fellow who had made the tune up taught it to a friend of his that also played the banjo with the request that when he died, he wanted that played at his funeral, or at his wake. And when he passed away, of course, they complied with his wishes and played the thing all night at his wake, and it was called The Dead Man's Piece. And I think it's a real characteristic West Virginia-type banjo tune, and maybe a Lee Hammond-type banjo tune in particular, in that it's a simple melody that doesn't require a whole lot of technique and involvement with the left hand, but it kind of, the way it just rolls along. I'll just play it. I'd rather do that than talk.
I've listened to that tune a while, but it seems to me, just hearing it right off the rib like that, that it's what I would call an old crooked sort of a tune.
Yeah, it's kind of a crooked tune.
And there are a lot of crooked tunes in West Virginia, and there's a lot of sort of crooked countryside. Crooked. Well, it isn't in straight, you know,
Ethel
even time.
Say.
Yeah.
Why don't?
Can we call on our resident music theorist?
Oh, but he was there at that. I don't know.
Could you?
I don't know.
But I think this is Ron's really hit on something here, and that there's a sense of home, there's a sense of terrain in this central West Virginia repertoire, unlike any place I've ever. And of course, I've never understood the music as well in other parts of the country either. So, but it just seems to me like here that music really has that sense about it. What about singing styles, Ethel? How did the old people sing? I mean, they carried themselves different, didn't they, when they sang, and used a different part of their larynx when they. Have you thought about it or analyzed it? Can you sing an old style for us? Some beautiful unaccompanied old thing.
Okay. When these two gentlemen were playing, it brought something back to me. I keep referring to my parents, but I have to. My dad played guitar, acoustical guitar, and that's the reason why he wanted a piano player, because he was tired of playing guitar. And the style. I wish I had learned. See, this is one of the things as a young person I was not interested in. Although I would watch him play, I really never learned how to pick a guitar because he had a different pick. And I was trying to explain it to someone the other day, and they said that was an old style of guitar playing. And like you, you know, watching someone like you, learning from an older person, I probably would have been able to preserve another portion of my heritage. But he played... when he would tune the guitar, boom, 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 da 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 da, boom, 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 boom. That's how he would play it, you know. I can remember how he would tune it, but I would never be able to tune it. I don't know the style or anything, but that was the way he would tune it. Now he wanted to sing an old-fashioned song.
I want to get with my guitar with you after a while, see if I can get that tune.
I can tell you how, but I can't tell you what the notes are, but I can hum it for you.
Okay.
Open tune.
How about Waiting on a Stranger?
Oh, I don't know.
She'll think of something.
I just keep coming up with this one old song. I think I was telling them. It has the tune of Amazing Grace, but I've heard some old people sing it in such a way. I love the Lord. He heard my cry and pitied every groan. Shall see the great King and
close of the day, I shall see the great King and his beauty when I've gone the last mile of the way.
Dorothy, I was wondering what this, if any of this music that we've been listening to reminds you at all of patterns in your work, or the texture of your work in any kind of a way. Olive?
Doesn't remind me of any of my weaving, but in primary school, one of the teachers taught us to sing do re mi fa so la ti do, do ti la so fa mi re do. That's all I remember. since then, I've tried to learn the shape notes, but I waited too long. Everybody should learn them when they're young.
What are they? What's a shape note? I don't know.
Well, she could tell. C.
I'm just now learning.
C is a
different shape, triangles and
now Pemberton knows it. Let him explain it.
Well, I don't know. I could draw it if I had a blackboard. Now, where they're placed on the staff don't make too much sense to me. Although it is true that you go from low do to high do. And like she sang, do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. You got a good range, you keep that going. Do, ti, la, sol, fa, mi, re, do. It'll always be that unless they sharpen it to fi instead of fa. Is that right? And then it will be just a half step. That's all I know. But I could draw each one of them because it's in my mind sufficiently to know.
Each one
like
of the notes has a different shape.
Me is a diamond. Me is a diamond.
Diamond note, square note.
And a soul is that round one you don't know anything about when they put all souls all the way up.
That's all.
That don't mean nothing.
And then when you're singing, you're supposed to be able to sing do mi sol, do sol mi do.
Right. When you have a group that's together, they know exactly what to do, and they'll go. Sometimes they have a pitch fight. And they'll blow the note, and then the bum, 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 and they'll call the note that they're singing. And they may go through the whole song one time, just sing, fa, so, mi, ro, re, no, do, mi, so, fa, bum, 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 bum. So, mi, fa, re, me, do, bum, 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 bum. But they'll say each one either do, re, mi, fa, so, la, ti, or whatever it is. But they'll sing that syllable. Then they'll go back and sing the words. After they do maybe one or two choruses, then they go back and sing the words.
So it's a system of notation that's based on
the amount of time you space. Do, re, mi, re, mi, re, mi, mi, fa, sol, la, sol, la, sol. It's the time that you... I don't know about it.
These
shapes don't necessarily need to be placed on a staff.
I like to
say. They can be written at the same. They can be written on the same line. Right. In fact, isn't that right, Jimmy?
So far as
they go up and down. I have a just to show you that it's not such an antiquated idea or system. I have a cousin who is an opera singer. She has sung around Washington. She's now in Austin, Texas, and we were talking about this do re mi fa so. Do system, which I'm not too familiar with, but she told me, she said, I to this day, when I learn a piece, she says, I do not go by notation. She went to universities and schools and all. She said, I sing all my pieces. I started out on the do, re, mi in opera, the Mikado and all of them. She said, I use the do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do scale. So there we are. You know, people recognize quality and worth and value in something that's old. Though they were taught different, she was taught different. Somewhere she knew about the do, re, mi, and she uses it in all of her.
This system was vastly popular and widely used in New England up through the middle of the 19th century, pretty much when it began to die out. But it's there are 30 million people in the South today who know this system and who use it all the time, and yet most professional musicians have never heard of it. Don't have the faintest idea that it exists. Yeah.
Is there any indication of time?
time or the length of time you hold a note?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. That makes the song.
Same as other music.
So many steps on a ladder without...
But it's got seven notes. It can be, the system can be placed in any scale that you want, in any key. And old shape note singing masters used to come into communities and stay a week, and they could teach a whole community in a week's time to become literate, musically literate with this system. I'm speaking personally as a musical illiterate, but I never was raised on shape notes, so I didn't learn any music.
Soprano sang their line, the alto sang their notes, and the tenor sang their notes, and the bass sang their notes.
Our teacher died recently. We've been in less than the last 10 years, and he held singing schools in our community and other places. And that was the purpose for the whole meeting. Well, sure, they probably have prayer. West Virginia people religious. They might not all see it the same way, but they're religious. And anything of a nature of singing gospel songs is going to open with a prayer of some kind. We don't believe it's wrong to pray. I heard a story one time. School teacher got on to a couple of kids that they seen on their knees, and we're going to correct them for it. And she said, "You know, they passed law. You're not allowed to pray." They said, "We're shooting crap." She said, "That's all right."
There was a young man who shared with me a book the other day, and it's called the Colored Sacred Heart Songbook. And it was a group in Alabama, in Ozark, Alabama, and he had a copy of the book and he gave it to me as a gift after I was talking about shape note singing. And it has a whole, they call it the rudiments, and they have a whole section on rudiments of shape note, and I'm starting to study it. I started reading it as soon as he gave it to me.
Was it Sacred Heart or Sacred Harp?
H-A-R-P, Harp, Sacred Heart Singers.
There's some, excuse me.
That's okay.
You were talking about the old singing schools. There's a friend of mine at home that has all the old charts that they taught the shape notes. His grandfather taught singing schools. And if you remember your chart maps in high school, they were like that. There were companies. In fact, the old McGuffey, Van Alt work that printed the old McGuffey readers that so many people used in the rural school system, the old McGuffey readers. Printed those big charts. They were very formal, and they would fold back, you know, and they would show the whole system. And there is a set of those charts, I think, in that museum at Marlington, which I hope to go by tomorrow with my group as we go home.
Good.
Yeah, there's a set.
You know, sitting around here, if I were visiting West Virginia for the first time and were sitting and listening to this discussion, it just occurred to me that I might be hearing people talking as though trying to preserve this. Some of these old things was a difficult thing, that it was a kind of an uphill battle. It was, we've been talking about trying to keep these things alive, trying to preserve them as though there was some kind of threat or something pushing down, something pushing them under.
Michael, let me ask you a question.
Wait a minute. If that's the case, okay. Olive, I wonder if you could tell us what you think is threatening these old ways and why it, you know, why we're having such a tough time with this.
You mean to preserve?
Yeah. What's going to replace them, or what's threatening them?
Well, we're not going to be replaced. We're going to hang on. We're trying to teach other people to hang on. We don't want them replaced.
You know, there's a revival in craft right
now. I think we're going in that way. You know, one of the things that I have worried about, I'm 78 years old. Who's going to take my place when I'm no longer here to do it? Mm-hmm. But I have weavers that I'm more confident now, because I have weavers that can take over. You know, they're going to take over when I quit. We have a group. And we're working on it, so we're not going to give it up.
I'd like to speak to the musical side of that.
Are you?
No, I feel like what's good is going to have lasting power.
Right.
You know, uh-huh. There's music that we play, Jimmy plays, and Ron plays, that's 300 and 400 years old and maybe older. We don't even know. Well, why has it been here this long? Mm-hmm. You know, it's been worth something.
And we're trying to teach the younger people to follow in their footsteps.
And
I think that's one great thing about Augusta.
I think it's one of the greatest things that happened. And I think even the Arts and Craft Fair in West Virginia, getting that started again and getting this thing upheavaled, really. And then our own Augusta, I think, has done wonders. And I've heard lots and lots of people say this very thing. And I think we're working towards...
You're right. We're not scared now. It used to be. It kind of felt like it.